Let's talk about how you first heard of the USS Indianapolis. I know you were pretty young then. You had a National History Day project to do when you were 12 years old. How did you first stumble upon this tragedy?
Yeah, that's actually a pretty neat story. First of all, I've grown up in Florida and a big fisherman and outdoorsman, and my dad's favorite movie was Jaws. And so we would periodically watch that movie when it came on TV, or we would rent the movie, and we just happened to be sitting on the foot of my parents' bed one afternoon, and Jaws was on. My dad and I were watching it, and we came upon the scene in the movie where Captain Quint and some of the other guys on the ship or on the boat, and they're just talking about shark bites and tattoos they had removed, and that leads into Captain Quint, his kind of famous soliloquy there on the USS Indianapolis. As it turns out, he was on the Indianapolis, and it is because of that that he dedicated the rest of his life to taking revenge on sharks because of what the sharks had done to so many of his shipmates when their ship sank and they were in the water. And so it was because of that scene right there that I stood up and asked my dad if it were a true story. And he knew about as much as I did. He thought it was true, but neither of us really knew. And from that point, I went to the library and started doing research on the Indianapolis, found out it was true, and found out so much more. And that became the topic for my History Fair project for that National History Day competition.
And that dialogue, as I understand, I read that Robert Shaw actually ad-libbed some of that or did some of that writing himself.
I think he was some of that writing himself. I think he was inebriated during that scene, at least from my understanding.
You were on the Indianapolis?
What happened? Japanese submarine slammed two torpedoes into our side, Chief. He was coming back from the island of Tinian Delady, just delivered the bomb, the Hiroshima bomb. 1,100 men went into the water. Vessel went down in 12 minutes. Didn't see the first shark for about half an hour. Tiger, 13-footer. You know that when you're in the water, Chief? You tell by looking from the dorsal to the tail. Well, we didn't know. Was our bomb mission had been so secret, no distress signal had been sent. They didn't even list as overdue for a week.
There were a few factual errors, just minor. As a matter of fact, they even got the wrong month, if you listen closely, as to when the Indianapolis sank. But other than that, I mean, it's a really catchy scene, and it caught my attention.
But that may not have been something to blame them for, because you had to do pretty extensive research at that time to find out the real facts involved.
Right, absolutely. And little did I know that would be the beginning of a several-year research journey that extended far beyond the duties of that school project, the National History Day, and then eventually on into Congress.
So where'd you get all your research done?
Oh, all over the place. I started off in trying to get in touch with survivors. That is after I read the book Fatal Voyage, which was a book that I found on the Indianapolis. And I tried to get in touch with the survivors, and the way I was able to do that, I put an ad in the Gosport, which is the local Navy newspaper here in Pensacola. And that led me to a survivor who lived in Mobile, Alabama, which is like 45 minutes away from my house. And I contacted him, set up an interview with him. And during that interview, at the end of it, he gave me a list of all of the other survivors. And so from that list, I was able to contact, eventually, all of the remaining survivors who are still alive, contact them and ask them for any information that they had on the Indianapolis. Many of them I sent this to in the form of a questionnaire that they could answer. And then others I wrote letters to asking if they could send me any artifacts that they had and didn't mind making a copy of or donating or loaning to me for this research project. And on top of that, once the project sort of got rolling and on past the National History Day competition into the legislative efforts that followed to exonerate the captain and received some media attention, people from all over the world then started tracking me down and saying, "Hey, Hunter, I understand that you've got some momentum rolling on the exoneration of Captain McVeigh and the Indianapolis, and I played such a role in that story, and I'd like to send you my story."
We'll talk about, what you learned about Captain McVeigh and what was unjust after what you had read and discovered.
Right. Well, in the very beginning, after I first read the book Fatal Voyage that kind of gave my first overview or synopsis of the story, I immediately realized and recognized that something wasn't right. Dan Kurzman did an excellent job of saying that Captain McVeigh was court-martialed unjustly. But even then, no one had the full story, because the full story was really dispersed among people all over the world, whom the Navy had really tried to quiet back in 1945 and really tried to downplay the sinking of the Indianapolis. And so as I began talking to survivors and doing more and more research, I really began to get a sense that Captain McVeigh was court-martialed unjustly, that it was not his fault, that it was the fault of many people in the Navy who should have been reprimanded. Many of them were not. And that, in fact, Captain McVeigh was court-martialed unjustly and found guilty of something that he wasn't guilty of, that he didn't do. And he ended up taking his own life. And so it was really a six, almost seven-year journey that led up to this point. But it was long before that that I actually realized that Captain McVeigh was not responsible for the loss of the ship. And then sometime after that, that Congress and the Navy realized that, in fact, Captain McVeigh was not responsible for the loss of the ship.
Maybe you could talk about 2000, the congressional resolution signed, and how that generated more writing about this and others to do their research.
Sure. President Clinton signed the legislation that exonerated Captain McVeigh in October of 2000. And with that, it was kind of the formal recognition, and the legislation said that Captain McVeigh was not responsible for the loss of his ship and should not have been court-martialed. And that legislation awarded a naval unit commendation to the final crew of the USS Indianapolis. And so I went from this until October 2000, and now if you type in USS Indianapolis on the Internet, you get more than I can count and could ever look at of returns all about the Indianapolis. And so with this passage of the legislation that exonerated Captain McVeigh, it was significant because this legislation actually changed history. As a matter of fact, Gordon England, who was the Secretary of the Navy at that time, had someone pull Captain McVeigh's naval record, attach the legislation to it that said he was not responsible for the loss of his ship, and that essentially changed what was written in history books and had been written in history books for almost 60 years.
And, you know, what role did this play, if any, in your own career? Did this help you decide to serve in the military, or was this something that you'd already decided on?
Well, great question. My work with the survivors has really instilled a strong desire for me early on to want to serve my country as they did. And also growing up in Pensacola and seeing the Blue Angels, which is the Navy's air show team, has really, I thought, was pretty cool. And so I knew really early on, I guess in middle school, that one day I wanted to either go to the Naval Academy or join the Navy after school. And so I'm able to say now that I'm here in flight school back in Pensacola, and I see the Blue Angels flying over every morning, almost every morning as I drive into work. And so it's really a blessing for me to be able to say, now I get to serve my country like my heroes, the men of the USS Indianapolis.
Well, anything else you'd like to add on your research and what you're, outside of your work in flight school, what else you're doing to further this cause?
Well, from my understanding, with the passage of the legislation and talking to people in the Navy, the legislation goes as far as the exoneration effort can go, unless the president himself actually pulls the naval record and then makes the physical change, which is erasing the actual record from the transcript, which I don't know if you follow me there, but the difference is right now we have the court martial still on his record, and then this official legislation saying it shouldn't be there. I guess the next step further would be to get the president himself to pull that naval record and then actually physically erase the court martial.
How were you first contacted, or how did you first hear about the prospects of a Hollywood film?
That's another neat story. There were several trips that many of the survivors and I, and of course my family, made to D.C. to lobby for support for this legislation that we had introduced. And one producer from Hollywood would accompany us on these trips. And he would while we were lobbying Congress, he would lobby for our rights to produce a movie. And so once this particular producer had started meeting with survivors, and then he would go back to Hollywood and then come meet with us again, then it seemed the other studios in Hollywood it seemed that all of a sudden they became interested in this story as well. And throughout the course of a year, I don't remember exactly which year this was, my family and I met with 7 different movie studios throughout the year who would all send representatives to really see what it would take to get the rights of the script and to get the rights of the story and of myself and my family and the survivors and Captain McVeigh's sons to be able to produce this story on the big screen. And so we finally decided that Universal Studios would be the studio, and we decided that we really liked Chris Moore, who you may know from his work in Good Will Hunting. And so we've been working with him for several years now, and we've worked with several different writers there in Hollywood. And so hopefully that movie will be coming to fruition in the next several years.
But nothing has actually been shot as of yet.
Right, nothing has been shot. As a matter of fact, we just received a completely new fourth script. Universal's written 4 scripts so far, and so it'll be interesting to see what they think of this one.
Do you know, will this be entirely a recreation of what happened that year and that tragedy?
My understanding is that it will be kind of 2 stories simultaneously. One is the story of the Indianapolis and of Captain McVeigh following their efforts to deliver the atomic bomb and then the sinking of the Indianapolis and then the court-martial of Captain McVeigh. And then simultaneously, I think that we'll get a picture of this young boy some 50 years later whose path just happens to cross with a survivor of the Indianapolis. And at one time they talked about doing something with these 2 stories, and I'm not sure how that they would intertwine these together, but I think the movie would tell both stories, one of the legislative efforts of a young boy and the survivors 50 years later, and then 2, and what I think is the main story there, is the sacrifice of so many men there at the end of the war.
So do you have some say in who plays you?
Well, I guess technically I do. They run it by me and make sure it's okay.
Is it only fitting? You know, you watched Jaws, a Universal film from, I believe, 1976 that first piqued your interest. Does it seem only fitting that now they're planning to release this next film?
I know. It does seem kind of cool when you think about it.